This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 2nd of July, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear about McCain and Obama's positions on free trade. South Central farmers and their supporters denounce a plan that they say will pollute their community. Human rights groups mobilize in Eugene, Oregon during the U.S. Olympic track and field trials. And we'll hear about domestic workers organizing in New York, where a recent case highlighted the abuse and torture of two workers from Indonesia. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Colombia's defense minister says a group of commandos has rescued a former presidential candidate and three U.S. private contractors that the FARC guerrillas have held captive for several years. Ingrid Betancourt and the three American contractors were the highest-profile hostages held by the Colombian rebels. 11 captured Colombian soldiers were also freed in the rescue operation. The Colombian military says no one was killed in the surprise maneuver. The FARC has long sought a deal to exchange their hostages for imprisoned guerrillas held by the government. Three Israelis are dead and more than 40 are wounded after a Palestinian construction worker drove a bulldozer into traffic on a busy West Jerusalem street today. Ghassan Benoura reports from Bethlehem.
A Palestinian from Jerusalem was behind the wheel of a bulldozer that plowed through traffic on one of Jerusalem's main streets. Israeli police shot and killed the driver. Israeli police sources confirmed that the attacker, Taysir Dwekat, aged 31, has a criminal record. No Palestinian armed group claimed responsibility for the attack. The bulldozer hit a number of cars and overturned a bus in an area of Jerusalem dominated by Orthodox Jews. The attacker was reportedly a worker at a nearby construction site. Today's incident occurred in the same neighborhood where an armed Palestinian killed 8 students at a Jewish seminary in March of this year. Israeli authorities are calling the incident a terror attack and have announced a state of high alert in Jerusalem. For FSRN, I'm Ghassan Banoura in Bethlehem.
Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has rejected calls by African leaders to craft a power-sharing agreement with longtime President Robert Mugabe. Tsvangirai, who garnered more votes than Mugabe in the general elections, withdrew from the presidential runoff vote just days ahead of polling, citing widespread violence and intimidation against opposition supporters. Mugabe went on to win the one-candidate race. The African Union wrapped up a two-day summit in Egypt yesterday with a resolution calling on the two rivals to form a unity government. The European Union made a similar proposal today, suggesting that Tsvangirai serve as Mugabe's prime minister. Tsvangirai's party, the Movement for Democratic Change, says the AU resolution does nothing to address the months of state-sponsored violence targeting the opposition. A British judge spoke out publicly today against new government-imposed rules obliging judges to dismiss an asylum seeker's story if that refugee entered the UK using a false passport. That means any other evidence they present becomes irrelevant, as they must be automatically deported. Meanwhile, the British government is investigating a claim that a 26-year-old rejected asylum seeker from Cameroon was so badly assaulted by security guards during her forced removal that she now has to use a wheelchair. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
This allegation is one of hundreds that have been compiled by anti-deportation campaigners, but this one is being investigated due to the involvement of Belgian officials. Stephanie Toomey says British security guards assaulted her and forced her head down for 2 hours on a flight last month. When the plane touched down in Brussels in order to change planes for Cameroon, Belgian immigration officials refused to allow the escort team to fly her any further because of her injuries. The British government contracts private security firm Group 4 Securicorps to escort rejected asylum seekers from the UK. With recent anti-immigration legislation passed through the European Parliament last month, forced removals are an increasingly lucrative business. British Airways earns more than $8 million a year to carry failed asylum seekers and their escorts. Anti-deportation activists have successfully persuaded XL Airlines to pull out of a $3 million government contract, and they're targeting other airlines. Hundreds of deportations have to be aborted every year because regular passengers complain at the unpleasant scenes. convert a new airline company specialising in forced removals, nicknamed Asylum Airways, expects to win a high number of European government contracts. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In response to the Supreme Court decision that detainees at Guantanamo Bay have a right to challenge their detention in the U.S. court system, a D.C. District Court judge has been assigned to coordinate and manage proceedings in a legal process that will begin next Tuesday. The so-called enemy combatants were stripped of their rights under the writ of habeas corpus by the Military Commissions Act that Congress passed in 2006. The Supreme Court reinstated those rights last month. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Presumptive Republican presidential nominee John McCain is in Colombia to talk free trade, a market model he fully backs. But as McCain hypes free trade, questions have risen about Democrat Barack Obama's position on the matter. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Senator McCain is unabashedly free trade. Speaking with Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, McCain pushed a free trade agreement with Colombia.
I note that a free trade agreement has been concluded between Colombia and Canada, and you are negotiating with the European Union as well. I hope that we could move forward with a free trade agreement between our two countries.
The Colombian free trade agreement has been held up in Washington by Democrats who oppose, for reasons including that Colombia is one of the most dangerous countries for workers to organize. Senator McCain has supported every free trade agreement to go through Congress, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, Peru, and others. McCain has a 100% free trade approval rating from the free market think tank Cato. According to media reports, on the plane ride to Colombia, McCain called Democrat Senator Barack Obama a protectionist when it comes to trade. But Obama's trade position is coming under scrutiny, as some say he's moving to the center now that the general election is underway. Obama economic advisor Jason Furman says his policy has always been the same.
What Barack Obama has always wanted is trade agreements that put us on a level playing field, that we enforce, and that lift everyone up rather than leading to a race to the bottom. And that's what he would pursue as president rather than what George Bush has done, which is cut trade deals with countries that have unacceptable levels of violence against trade unionists, cut bad deals for auto manufacturers or not farmers, and really not try to protect workers and the environment.
In a bitter primary race in Ohio against Senator Hillary Clinton, Obama took a tough stance against free trade, sharply criticizing NAFTA. Obama said he would unilaterally renegotiate the free trade agreement. But in an interview with Fortune magazine released last week, Obama admitted to using, quote, overheated and amplified campaign rhetoric. Advisor Jason Furman says Obama will work with Canada and Mexico to renegotiate a better deal for workers and the environment in all three countries.
The importance of trade unions. You want to make those a strong and enforceable part of NAFTA.
Todd Tucker, trade researcher for Public Citizen, says Obama's trade policy has been inconsistent.
I think that his campaign is trying to figure out what its trade position is, and certainly they could learn from their own good performance in Iowa and Wisconsin.
Obama's supporter, Ambassador Robert Gilbard, says trade agreements aren't one-size-fits-all.
It's a question of what the content of those agreements are. It's not an issue of supporting free trade agreements just blindly.
As for the stalled Colombia free trade agreement, the Obama campaign says he won't support it until worker protections are strengthened and people are prosecuted in Colombia for past crimes against workers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
An inmate in a Maryland county jail in custody for the alleged murder of a county police officer was found strangled to death in his cell. No one has been charged, and with investigations underway, there hasn't been much cooperation. FSRN's Naji Mujahid reports.
On Friday, June 27th, 19-year-old Ronnie White was taken into police custody for the alleged killing of a police officer in Maryland. The officer, Corporal Richard Finley, 39, was struck by a pickup that police believe was stolen as they attempted to stop the vehicle. Mr. White, The driver of the vehicle was found dead in his cell 2 days later. The autopsy report from the state's medical examiner determined the cause of death to be asphyxiation and strangulation. It was also revealed that he suffered a broken neck and two broken ribs. At a press conference held yesterday outside the county courthouse, the lawyer representing the family spoke and shared the sentiment of the family in the analysis of a flaw in the system that may have allowed vigilantism to take place. Attorney Bobby Henry Jr.
We are standing in front of the circuit court here in Prince George's County. This is where justice is dispensed regularly, not in the county detention facility.
Investigations have begun. The Bureau of Administration at the county jail stated that their internal investigations have been suspended until the outside investigations currently being conducted by the Maryland State Police and the FBI are concluded. An undisclosed or undetermined number of corrections personnel had access to Ronnie White as he was being held in solitary confinement. There were seven officers on duty responsible to check his cell every 30 minutes with access, plus their supervisors. Thus far, several have refused to speak with investigators, which has concerned the Prince George's County NAACP chapter president, June Dillard.
We have a concern about the correctional officers not being willing to interview and to talk to the investigators from the Maryland State Police and the FBI, because we have to find out exactly what went on. And those people involved being correctional officers must be interviewed completely and fully, because we must come to the bottom of this quickly.
She went on to estimate that there may have been as many as 25 officers with access to White. Prince George's County is the largest county in Maryland and borders on Washington, D.C., where last year a teenager was shot to death by police, and just as in this case, the FBI took leadership in the investigations. In May, the U.S. Attorney's Office determined that there was insufficient evidence to bring charges on the officers. The FBI, Maryland State Police, and the State's Attorney's Office all refused to comment because there is an ongoing investigation. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Najee Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
More than 2 years after being evicted from the land they toiled for more than a dozen years, the South Central farmers are once again taking public action. Ralph Horowitz, who purchased the land under what the farmers call a backroom deal with city officials, has proposed to develop a diesel big rig truck distribution center, which locals say will bring even more pollution to South Central. LA's city planning department has said it will allow the development without abiding by standard environmental impact report guidelines. Today, the farmers and their supporters took to City Hall, demanding the city consider what the pollution from massive diesel exhaust and toxic air contaminants will mean for nearby homes and schools. Rosa Romero is a longtime South Central Farm supporter. She explains Horowitz's plans.
Basically, Horowitz has submitted a proposal to build a mega warehouse that, according to his own report, would allow 72 diesel trucks that would be coming in and out of this mega warehouse every day, 24 hours a day.
And so how would this impact the local community there?
The community in South Central near the Vernon area is already high concentrated with warehouses, particularly diesels that take goods from the Alameda corridor. And nearby, there's Jefferson High School, there's different elementary schools, there's the Snyder Recreation Center. So these are places that specific populations, those of the elderly and children, are going to be adversely affected with higher asthma rates. South Central already has the highest heart disease and lung cancer rate of anywhere in L.A. County. And L.A. County has the highest rates of anywhere in the United States.
And you're at L.A. City Hall today. What are your demands there?
Basically, Horowitz is here at the Planning Committee, and he's trying to bypass the environmental impact report, saying that there will not be any negative adverse effects of building this mega warehouse. The community is here to state that they already think there's enough congestion in the area, enough traffic, enough pollution, that their children are already suffering asthma, that there's already a lot of noise pollution, that they're hearing trucks all the time, it's hard to sleep. And so the residents right now currently are giving their testimony that they don't think that there is a community benefit to this mega warehouse. Horowitz's lawyer right now is saying that this will bring 1,200 new jobs to the community. But when you look deeper into his report, it's not 1,200 new jobs in the community. It's a consolidation of other warehouses in the area to the area. So there actually is no new job creation. So there's no positive impact in the community.
And how do you think that the city is going to respond to this?
Well, right now we have reports that came in, national organizations that are demanding that they do an environmental impact report and actually do serve residents. And so I think that what's going to come out of this is at least they're going to look into the effects on the population in the area, including wildlife species of birds that migrate to this place that have been migrating for years. So that they can actually look at what the impact is in the area and possibly find another solution to the area. Many people here do think it should go back to the community and be a green space as it was for 14 years as a South Central farm.
Rosa Romero adds that the proposal for the land is part of a larger plan to further industrialize parts of L.A., which will result in a negative impact for the entire county. Public awareness around the topic of domestic workers' abuse has risen since the recent New York City ruling that sentenced a couple of violently abusing two housekeepers from Indonesia. For years, domestic workers from around the country have been gathering and strategizing to win labor rights nationally. FSRN's Christine Lewis has been covering the case of the Indonesian workers in New York and was at the Long Island court when the verdict came down. She brings us this report.
On Thursday, June 26, dozens of domestic workers from the New York City region gathered in front of the Long Island courthouse to rally in support of Samira and Inang, the two Indonesian domestic workers who were enslaved and tortured for years by their wealthy employers, the Sabnanis, who were being sentenced for their role in this shocking abuse and torture case. In what is now officially called a case of slavery, Vasha Sabnani was sentenced to 11 years in prison last week for her treatment of the two domestic workers. And late on Friday evening, her husband, Mahinder Sabnani, was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison. One of the workers, Inang, testified she was forced to eat 100 chili peppers, take 30 baths or showers in a row, and was beaten and cut by the missus. The other worker, Samira, slept on a thin mat and was allotted skimpy amounts of rice. She was not allowed to leave the house. Prosecutors called it truly a case of modern-day slavery. Joycelyn Gill Campbell, an organizer with Domestic Workers United, charged that for too long, domestic workers, who are primarily immigrant women of color, have been excluded from most labor laws and are vulnerable to their employers.
Let their sentence serve both as an example and deterrent to all those bad employers to keep them from even thinking of committing such terrible crimes against defenseless women. Women who are only guilty of serving their employers with dedication and respect, so that their homes are always clean and their children well cared for.
David Mejias, a Nassau County legislator, Democrat for Farmingdale, whose mother was also a domestic worker in the 60s, spoke at the rally. He was instrumental in getting a Bill of Rights for domestic workers passed in Nassau County and is urging the state to do the same.
Make sure today that we make an example of the Sabnanis and the abuse that they had upon these two really innocent victims. This type of abuse This type of exploitation happens every single day right here on Long Island, one of the best places to live in the world. Right here with this high standard of living, we have exploitation and abuse of women and immigrants as domestic workers. And we need to make sure that we set an example of these two criminals and give them the maximum sentence so that everybody understands that on Long Island, we do not tolerate the exploitation of women and immigrants. We are setting an example by passing, we've passed the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. We would like the state of New York to pass that Domestic Workers Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights that Mejias refers to is one that would grant basic rights like a living wage, sick pay, and vacation pay, as well as health benefits. It is not only needed in places like New York, but as Gloria Estema from the San Francisco-based group Power says that the same abuses exist for domestic workers in California.
Además, nosotras somos estamos en Estados Unidos.
And we will be especially powerful because we are in the belly of the beast. We are in the empire, and that our organizing here is so important.
Gloria was speaking at the first ever National Domestic Workers Congress, which took place recently in New York City. Nannies and housekeepers from Seattle, San Francisco, San Antonio, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Miami and Boston came to strategize about building workers' power. The alliance was formed out of the unity built at the United States Social Forum, which was held in Atlanta last year. New York was chosen as the site for the Congress as it heads up one of the strongest campaigns fighting for the rights, respect and reparation for domestic workers. Yet as many of the immigrant women were keen to point out, the struggle for domestic workers crosses borders. Ninaj is an organizer with Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees.
Possibly look at, on a national level, addressing the Department of Labor, and on the international level, reaching out to other organizations outside of this country that organize domestic worker and work towards the ILO vote that's going to happen in 2009 concerning domestic work, 2010 concerning domestic workers.
Reporting for FSRN, I am Christine Lewis with the Community News Production Institute.
Track and field is a big deal in Eugene, Oregon. The city, dubbed Tracktown USA, has a long history with the sport and is known for producing some of the best distance runners in the world. Running shoe giant Nike has its roots in the University of Oregon track program, and the university's Hayward Field is considered to be one of the premier venues in the world. But Eugene also boasts a thriving activist community. Jess Burns reports that as the U.S. Olympic track and field trials opened this weekend in Eugene, human rights organizations mobilized as well.
A little more than a week ago, the Olympic torch relay made its way through the Tibetan capital, Lhasa. And that, says Tenzing Kunratsang, was an insult.
Taking the torch through Tibet, there's only one reason. It's to legitimize the control over Tibetan sovereignty. The way they did it, you have to look at it. It is heavily militarized. They just paraded it through Tibet for only one reason, I think, just to prove that they have the hold over this country.
Kunratsang is the general secretary of the Portland Regional Tibetan Youth Congress. On Saturday, the group organized a day of marches and educational activities surrounding the trials. Tibetan independence groups from as far away as New York and California made the trip to Eugene. The goal of their presence, according to Kunratsang, is very specific.
On this weekend, we're here to reach out for the athletes to stand up against what's going on inside Tibet, to basically ask the question whether you as an individual as an athlete, wants to represent your country in a nation like China, which has a gross human rights violation.
Han Shan is the Olympics campaign coordinator for Students for a Free Tibet. He says he hopes their work today will carry over into Beijing.
We hope, you know, we can find that one athlete who could, you know, show that courage and character, not just determination and athletic skill, but that courage and character to stand up for the true Olympic principles, which are, you know, friendship, solidarity, and fair play. If anything happens inside Beijing, it will be a grand success. But obviously the Chinese government is making it very, very difficult.
But the Free Tibet groups were not the only ones taking advantage of the Olympic trials in Eugene. On Sunday, a local coalition of Students for a Democratic Society marched along the entrance route to raise awareness of the impacts of the Olympics and related events on poor and homeless communities. SDS Representative Leif Brecky.
Well, we've been seeing larger sweeps of the homeless community and more arrests. We're using the trials as a platform to get our message to mainstream Eugene and to let the cops know that we're watching them and that we are here to advocate for the homeless.
But the cops were keeping an eye on them as well. Although only about 25 people joined the SDS protesters, five local police officers on bike tailed the march. In the center of campus, about a block away from the security checkpoints and crowds, the Lane County Darfur Coalition staged an elaborate exhibit called Camp Darfur. Five tents, reminiscent of those found in refugee camps, each included interactive displays depicting different genocides of the past century. The connection between Darfur and the Olympics is not as obvious as Tibet's, but it's there, says organizer Jamie Simons.
China is the major political, economic, and military partner to the Sudanese government, which is using that partnership to carry out its genocide in Darfur.
But as with the other activists on the ground in Eugene, Simon says the Lane County Darfur Coalition says they are not there to protest the Olympics.
We support the athletes. We're not asking for a full-on boycott, but we are asking people to be conscious and by raising awareness about China's involvement, put them in the spotlight. If they're going to host the Olympic Games in Beijing, they're coming out as a really wonderful world power and a leader as a government. They also need to follow with their human rights actions and promoting human rights on a global scale.
The track and field trials in Eugene will continue through next Sunday, and at least one human rights group, the Tibetan Youth Congress, plans to launch another round of community and athlete engagement during the event. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon. China, China, the dream is in your
hands. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Kristen Schwartz. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Oscar Hernandez. Robert Loza is our intern. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.